I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are broadcasting from Chicago for the rest of the week, where we are attending the Unity Conference of Journalists of Color and bringing you stories from there and the city for the rest of the week. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a roundtable of journalists about the crime beat, how they deal with two of the most emotional issues we ever cover, race and crime. Plus, we'll meet a community organizer who followed in Barack Obama's footsteps. But first, our newsmaker interview. She is Chicago-born and bred and became a national symbol of tenacity and accomplishment in 1992 when she became the first and so far only African-American woman ever elected to the U.S. Senate, Carol Moseley Braun.
Let us have faith that right makes might, and that in faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. I'm going to work hard to be the very best senator Illinois has ever had.
After serving one term in the Senate, she went on to represent the country as ambassador to New Zealand. And in 2004, she made a bid for the Democratic Party nomination for president. We are delighted to have her with us now, Ambassador. Thank you so much for stopping.
I'm delighted to be here and great to see you again. Welcome to Chicago. Happy to, that you're here with the Great Unity Conference. This is going to be a good conference.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about some of your latest ventures in a minute, which is very interesting as a model for life after a high-profile political career. But first, you know, I have to talk about politics with you. So what's your take on the presidential race? Have you endorsed?
Michelle, no, I'm out of politics altogether. I call myself a recovering politician. I have been focused exclusively and entirely on food, agriculture, and doing my part to improve the food supply for the American people. And so that's my contribution now. I'm out of politics.
It's a very interesting switch. I want to talk to you about that. But I have to ask you, because you've lived this intersection of race, gender, and power for really your entire career, as we said, the only African-American woman senator, only the second African-American senator post-Reconstruction, second African-American woman to run for president. I wanted to ask, how did you react, even as a recovering politician, to this discussion of race and gender, which was so much a part of the nomination process this year?
Well, both those issues are cultural issues. And on the one hand, I was and am delighted that the country has moved as far as it has on the issue of race. I'm old enough to remember segregation pre-Dr. Martin Luther King. And so race has, we've made some strides. There's still steps to be taken, but we've made some strides culturally as a people. Gender, we've made some strides also, but frankly, less so. The gender roles, gender issues, assumptions remain more closely embedded, I think, in the culture. And I think a friend of mine explained that's because that's who you live with. That's a home. That's the people, that's your mother, your sister, your daughter. Whereas race has to do with people who are outside of the home very often. It's how you treat the other. And sometimes it's easier to correct how you treat others than how you treat the folks who are closer in. And maybe that's the answer. I don't know that it is necessarily, but I was really struck by the dynamics of the two in this race as a cultural matter, not just as a political one.
People often quote Shirley Chisholm, the late great congresswoman from New York, my hometown, who was the first African-American woman to run for the president. She was quoted as saying that gender played a bigger role in her life than race, which some people find surprising. How do you feel about that?
I agree with her. And I got to tell you, I caught some flack for saying that. But gender remains a very troubling issue on some very deep levels. And we haven't gone as far as we'd like, or frankly, that we think we have. You scratch the surface on that one and you really get some interesting kinds of pushback. Mm-hmm. So I think that, frankly, you know, you handle one and you make progress, and then you look and you deal with the other and hopefully make progress. So I'm optimistic about it. Having said all that, I'm very optimistic about the direction that our country is headed, on both with regard to race and gender and sexuality, which is another part of it. I'm very optimistic about it because of the progress we've made so far and because of our sensitivity to the issue. If nothing else, this last election, the primary election on the Democratic side at least, made the whole country take a good look at these issues in a different way.
Do you feel, though, that the Senator Hillary Clinton, you know, fought very hard for the nomination, came close, just didn't, you know, cross the line. Now, obviously, as many people were as excited about her, a lot of people excited about Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. A lot of crossover between those groups, sort of quiet as it's kept. But do you feel, or as a person who's walked in those shoes, that her failure to secure the nomination is a setback for women? Do you think it says anything bigger than the fact that she just didn't make it? It wasn't women, that woman didn't make it.
You know that old line about success has 1,000 parents and failure is an orphan. I don't think it was personal to Hillary Clinton. I don't. I think she put up she did a good job. She ran a good campaign. I mean, all campaigns are chaotic and bizarre, but she did as good a job as anyone could. Of course, she was up against the superstar of the age, and Barack Obama's campaign was absolutely brilliant in the way that it was executed. So she didn't have an easy road to hoe, if you will. Having said that, I found it very interesting that her campaign, her candidacy, raised issues of gender in new ways and in ways, I mean, I've seen a lot of it, been there, done that, if you will. I've seen a lot of it, but it was really, I think a lot of people were surprised that it would apply even to the former First Lady.
If you're just tuning in, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Carol Moseley Braun, former U.S. Senator from Illinois, former ambassador to New Zealand, and now an entrepreneur here in Chicago, where we're broadcasting this week. Before I let you off the hook on this politics, what do you think is the most pressing issue that you want to see Senator Obama and Senator John McCain talk about or tackle over the course of the rest of the campaign?
What's that line from the old Clinton campaign? Is the economy stupid? I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, the war obviously is huge and will resolve itself. I think we're on a track to get that resolved. The economy is a little scarier because so many people are suffering. So many people are out of work on the one hand. On the other, the capital markets are still, up in the air and roiled by not just the housing crisis, but by the failure of investment. Everybody's stock market is still in turmoil. And while on the one hand, there's the notion that, you have these economic corrections, at the same time, this is a correction that could very well slide into a genuine, to use the word that is never spoken, depression. And I hope it doesn't happen, obviously. But the recessionary aspects of what we're going through right now, added to the threat of inflation sitting in the background, I mean, you've got all these things going on, and the average citizen feels it, not just at the gas pump, but in the grocery store, in terms of the cost of their taxes, because the way we've done tax policy in this country has been a disaster also, in my opinion. People are hurting, and I don't think for all of the political noise and all of the conversation, it has not, in my opinion, actually focused in a laser-like fashion on the plight and the concerns of everyday, ordinary Americans in terms of, their health care, their kids' education, whether or not they're laid off, whether or not they can afford their mortgages. I mean, those are the concerns I think the American people have foremost in their minds.
One of the concerns that people have in this city is crime.
Yep.
And that is not always seen as a federal issue or an issue for the president to talk about. But on the other hand, some people say one of the reasons that the Obama candidacy is important is perhaps he can speak about issues in a way that other people might not. Now, you sadly were a victim of a crime recently. You were attacked by a man who tried to steal your purse, broke your wrist. He was recently
convicted. Yes.
And imprisoned over this. And there have been some awful local stories recently. A young man just the other day was shot to that teenager, the second in a week. Why do you think this is happening? As briefly as you can for something so complicated.
As briefly as I can, I think, again, the lack of jobs, the lack of activity, the lack of it's almost as though there's like a demon going through the streets and encouraging these kids to lose sight of the fact that life is precious. And so the lack of respect for life gives rise to them attempting to express themselves with their weapons and killing each other. It's a genocide within the community.
And I just have to save in the minute time we have left. I've got to ask about your latest venture, Ambassador Organics. I think it's fair to say that most of the people who've had a career as high profile in yours in politics go into lobbying or something like that. Why this venture? Why does it engage you so?
Something completely different. Well, it's a way of contributing to a better and improved food supply for the American people. It's a way of continuing to be engaged in issues of agriculture, which are near and dear to my heart. And I started off to do a farm, an organic farm, and that morphed into an organic food company. And so we have Ambassador Organics. We're on the shelves in a number of the larger retailers on the internet, ambassadororganics.com with an S. And so we're growing. It's a little company. It's still very small, but we're trying to grow it. And I'm looking forward to doing more of this.
Is it a tough sell on this market? I mean, it's so interesting that you're hitting this at a time when we're talking about the rise in energy prices and the rise in food prices.
It is a tough time to start a business, but hey, you know, you don't necessarily pick timing. It happens sometimes. And in this case, this was the timing that I have. And so I'm just going to continue to plug along with it and try to grow the business, get distribution in stores, and hope people will go out and buy the products.
And are people surprised when they see a former ambassador talking about going to the food shows to talk about organic, food?
They are
intrigued.
They are, but organic. I believe organic food will give us healthier food, will give us better food, and given that our food supply is related so much to health. And it's that intersection, the health and the quality of the food. It's one thing to have a lot of food, which we have in this country, and fast food, which we have in this country. You also have to focus in on what is it that you're taking into your body for nourishment. Now, my line of tea, we have a line of tea and coffee and spices. They're not actually nutritional foods at this point. We hope to move into that. But at the same time, just making the case for organics, making the case for what we have is something called biodynamic organic, which is the highest quality organic. It's raised in ways to improve the soil and focus on sustainability as well. So environment, agriculture, healthcare, all these things come together around food, and that's why I'm so excited about
it. It's remarkable how, you know, food security and the quality of the environment have become cutting-edge issues, and you are kind of on the forefront of that. Carol Moseley Braun, former U.S. Senator, former ambassador to New Zealand, currently an entrepreneur. She's the founder and CEO of Good Food Organics, which produces a line of products called Ambassador Organics. She was kind enough to join us here at our member station, WBEZ, in Chicago. Thank you so much for speaking with
us. Just delighted to have you here.
Thank you. Is broadcasting from Chicago. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. For the rest of the week, we are broadcasting from Chicago, where we will be attending the Unity Conference of Journalists of Color and bringing you important stories from and about Chicago. A little later in the program, we're going to meet with a man who's following in Barack Obama's footsteps. He's a community organizer in Chicago. But what exactly does a community organizer do? We'll find out in a little bit. But first, we're going to be talking about issues in the media this week. So we decided to start with what might be one of the news business's most common assignments, but also one of the most complicated. Just about every news outlet covers crime. But crime can also play into race-based stereotypes. So how do reporters, especially those of color, find the right balance between being tough and being fair? We've assembled a roundtable of crime reporters. Ruben Rosario is a columnist for the Pioneer Press in Minnesota. Tiwa Chang is an investigative reporter for WWOR-TV, a Fox station in New York and New Jersey. Kara Briggs is a columnist for Indian Country Today. And Kathy Cheney reports for the Chicago Defender. Welcome. Great to talk to all of you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me just start this way. For some of you, crime reporting is a big part of the job. For others, it's just one of the things that you do. I wanted to ask each of you, when you thought about being a reporter, did you want to cover crime stories? I guess I'm asking, did you find it or did it find you? Ruben?
Well, not so much crime, because I grew up in New York and grew up with New York Daily News and getting the Bulldog edition at night. So, of course, as you know, Michelle, the Daily News has always been a very crime conscious tabloid in terms of following where the blood leads and where the bodies fall. But my passion was more to cover the communities where crime happened rather than covering the crime in those communities. So it was a little bit of a different perspective I had coming from the South Bronx and seeing the impact that crime had on my community when I was growing up as a child. So I had a different perspective than perhaps most of the veteran newsroom people there.
Tiwa, what about you?
I didn't plan on covering crime. I planned on being a doctor, like any good Asian kid. And then I just sort of gradually, I was telling Kathy, I actually lived in Chicago. I was a machinist at a place that's now the Bricktown Mall. But I got hired in Detroit, and when I got there, he said, "You're going to be the crime reporter." And I said, "Oh, okay." And so that's how I got started in crime reporting.
Wow. Kara, what about you?
I started out to be a features writer, and in my first day of daily newspapers, it was a huge murder, and I ended up covering it. And I have intermittently covered police reporting and crime and courts throughout my career, but of late, as a columnist with this national Indian newspaper, I found myself writing more about policy issues, about crime across Indian country.
Sure. Okay. And Kathy, what about you?
Crime reporting found me. My initial interest was in politics and just human interest stories. But at a paper that I worked at, one of the assignments was whenever a new reporter came on board, they had to go to the local police station and, you know, go to the review office and look at the crime rolls and do reports from that. And after I went there, I kind of got hooked on it, and I stayed with it.
That leads me to my next question. It may be an odd question, but a lot of people wonder, you know, how we can do what we do, how a lot of us can do what we do. So Kathy wanted to ask, what's the best thing about covering crime, and what's the worst?
The best thing is you get to help a family that's experiencing a tragedy show their pain to others, let others know, because they could be helping someone else who has gone through this that hasn't reached out or need to know how to, you know, deal with it. So that's the best part, is that you're helping that family help someone else and help themselves. But the worst part is just being on scene, on a murder scene, or going to a funeral, and it's just gut-wrenching when you see the family break down and you want to break down, but you can't. But sometimes, you know, nature just takes its course, and you just have to fall with it.
Why can't you? Why can't you feel what you feel? Is it, you just feel, you know, that would be unprofessional?
A little part of me does, but I'll tell you, this past Saturday, and me being a parent, I just let all that out the door.
What happened to those who don't know?
We had a 9-year-old girl named Maya Lyons who was stabbed to death last Tuesday. And her father found her in the alley about a half block away from their home. And we haven't had an incident like that in 10 years. The girl lived with her father part-time here. And this past Saturday, the family had scheduled to go to Great America, but instead they buried Maya Lyons. And I'll tell you, the parents couldn't even come into the church without stomping and crying and just nearly collapsing before they even got up to the casket. And it is so hard to not let something like that affect you. I have my daughter, my oldest daughter is 9, and there's no way. I mean, I tried to turn my head, tried to look up at the sky, I tried to suck in the tears, but it just flowed out, and so did the other reporters. It was like maybe the toughest funeral that we've all had to cover.
That's awful.
It was just really tough.
That's
yes,
awful.
It is.
Carol, what about you? What's the best and worst thing about covering crime?
I think that mystery stories, crime and police stories, if you just look at the, you know, popular television series, they're just part of our culture. I think they're very engaging in that way for people, and maybe in some ways that storytelling is what draws me to crime reporting, and that sometimes almost cut and dry. Here's the story. This is it. And yet, you know, I also agree. I remember being a younger crime reporter and for a period of a couple of years and feeling like I just became hardened, like there was a shell around myself. Because I think, you know, as Kathy was just saying, you do have to carry this facade sometimes, even to interact with maybe police agencies that are terser than might be normal for me. But I have found, and maybe even sometimes had, good relations, ongoing relationships with some families that I have reported on when they've had a death, and maybe not even necessarily a murder, but a suspicious death or a death that needed investigating. And that relationship was from the moment when they would cry and I would cry. I always tell my sources, if you cry, I cry.
Mm. Tiwa, what about you?
Well, you know, just a point. If you don't put up a shell, you'll go insane. I think my first job was Biloxi, Mississippi. It was a young man who worked in a sewage plant, and he drowns getting out of a tank full of human waste.
Mm.
And he was supposed to get married that weekend. Mm-hmm. And he drowned. Most drowning victims have their hands apart. His hands were together because he was very religious. And I remember that whole weekend, I was so miserable. And I think I just automatically after that turn off at a certain point. And I think it's important not to, because you have to be human. But if you don't, I think you could go crazy, literally. But in any case, what's great crime reporting is that when you can do some good. And I've done some stories, I think, that have changed things in society, and I think that's worthwhile. And the worst part about it is, you know, frankly, when you have to go up to a family who's just had a loss and you feel like a real you're invading their personal space and privacy and decency.
Ruben?
Well, for me, my first homicide as a rookie reporter at the Daily News was a 16-year-old who got killed in a drug-related homicide on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. And my last column was dealing with a gang banger from Mississippi who relocated to Minneapolis and has turned his life around. So those are the highs and the lows. The lows are actually going out and dealing with family members who have to deal with the loss of a loved one caught in the crossfires of violence. And the other one is seeing a sense of redemption. Crime, to me, is the thing that they send rookie reporters out to cover, but it's the most difficult one because it's, to me, it's the drama, it's the morality play that keeps going. And as long as homicides are still the exception rather than the rule, I think that's the reason why it fascinates us so much and why crime sells. But it depends on how you cover that crime. And to me, the highlights is, as the gentleman just said, is making that difference. It's letting people know that people can't change if they're ex-offenders. It's letting people know that victims can cope, can heal, not forget, but can heal and can overcome a great tragedy in their lives.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with reporters and columnists Kara Briggs, Ruben Rosario, Kathy Cheney, and Tiwa Chang about covering crime. Do you all ever feel that your ethnicity plays a role in the way you cover your stories or in the way you are perceived to? I think about this because I remember earlier in my career, people would ask me. I know that other senior African-American reporters have told me that often earlier in their careers, they'd be challenged. They say, well, what side are you on? That kind of thing. People would actually say this to them, or editors would ask them, are you a journalist first or are you black first? Now, I don't feel like I have to answer this question anymore, but it could be just because I've been around a while and I don't feel people don't, you know, they don't challenge you in that way, you know, when you're more experienced. But do you ever feel that your ethnicity does play a role either in how you see the story and how people see you covering the story? Tiwa, I'm going to ask you first because the visual, because you're in television, and people are going to know what your ethnicity is, whether you tell them or not.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, you know. Well, you know.
Anyway, yeah, no, I do. To be serious, I do let it play a role, because I'll give you a good example. Was growing up, I would see these stories on television in New York. I'm a native, born and raised in New York City, and I would see stories about Chinatown, where I did not live, and there were always gangs and killings, and I never saw anything positive growing up. And I remember I called up to complain once, and they started yelling at me for complaining. And I thought about it.
Who'd you call to complain, and who yelled at you? That's that's not customer service.
I called the TV station.
Wow.
The newsroom, they picked up, and they you didn't look last week, or something like that. Mm. Anyway, so I did a story. One of the stories I did that I'm most proud of was a story that changed the extradition laws between the United States and the Dominican Republic. Basically, cocaine hitmen and dealers were being hired who were of Dominican nationality because they could kill people and escape to the Dominican Republic, and there was no extradition treaty. And so I was writing this. I did a long investigative report, 32 reports over a couple of years. And I remember my very first story, I wrote something about Dominican killers. And it just somehow reminded me of these Chinatown stories I saw as a kid. So what I do whenever I do a story with any particular ethnicity, I replace that name of the ethnicity with Chinese. And I read it to myself to see how I feel about it. And I remember after I read it, these Chinese killers, I thought, well, I'm Chinese. I'm not a killer. So I changed it to say these killers from an area of Dominican and Dominican Americans, most of whom are honest and hardworking. I threw that line in there right after the first line. And I only did that because I put Chinese instead of Dominican, so I had a sensitivity toward that.
Hmm.
And after that, many Dominican and Dominican Americans who came up to me and said, you know, we appreciated that because we felt that you were not slamming us as an ethnicity, just the criminals among us.
Kara, what about you?
Well, most of my crime reporting has been about the white community because I've mostly worked in the Northwest, in Spokane, Washington, and in Portland, Oregon. But when my work passed into Native American communities, I would sometimes feel a coldness just out in the general urban Indian community. I remember I was reporting on the death of a girl from alcohol poisoning, a girl from a local reservation, while she was at a federal boarding school. And I remember walking through a room and half of my friends would turn away from me in sort of hostility over this coverage and half would say, you know, we're really glad you're writing about this difficult thing. What I feel is a profound responsibility when I have Native women elders who will come and sit down at a conference and talk to me intensely about the violence against Indian women. And what I'm left with is like a feeling that I need to do the reporting work. You know, and maybe in some cases work that is not going to be done by anyone else.
Yeah, you raise an interesting and important point, I think, which is there is this tension sometimes between people who are going to feel like you're airing dirty laundry and other people who say, look, this is vitally important. The story has to get out. Kathy, do you ever get that? Do you ever experience that?
Very few times, because the Chicago Defender is a black newspaper that is my audience, but there are certain instances where I have to keep in mind that the paper's not just read by black people. We had the Lane Bryant mall shooting, the murders here, and I remember that we got a call that there were two black women that were killed and three white women, and we covered the story, but we got calls that, you know, just... we didn't say enough about the white women. We put pictures of the black women in there. And I had to say, you know, I completely reported the story, as did every other news outlet. We included all women. It wasn't my decision whose picture got shown, but we included information about all the women, but that just wasn't good enough. So that made me a little bit more aware of, okay, yes, my audience is black. However, not all of it is.
Ruben, what about you? You're writing for a general audience paper, but you've discussed the fact that you have some sensitivities. You want to be sure that you know, as Reverend Jackson would say, if you're going to tell it all. How do you mediate those I don't know, maybe they're not conflicting demands in your view.
Back in 1982, Ron Howell, a veteran journalist, and I, we lobbied the New York Daily News newsroom to open up a bureau in Harlem on 125th Street. And the reason we did that is because of that traditional non-coverage of communities, particularly in New York, north of 96th Street in Manhattan. I'm sure you know about that, Michelle.
Sure do.
And for 3 years, we went up there and we decided not to cover so much crime unless there was a big picture issue. We cover economic development. We cover education, we cover affordable housing, and then we cover crime. And that what that created was a three-dimensional cushion of coverage. So I had that consciousness back in the 80s. Now as a columnist here in the Twin Cities, I am very conscious of not only my ethnicity, but people are very conscious of mine because I have my picture out there in the front pages. So, you know, when I write about immigration or something that has to do with crime, I hear it, and I hear it. You know, Mexican go back to Mexico. Well, I'm not Mexican. I'm Puerto Rican from New York.
You're a citizen. Hello.
Yeah, exactly.
But what about that? Do people ever accuse you of being politically correct if you try to sort of unpack a story in a way that perhaps gives it a different spin than it might have otherwise? Do people say, oh, you're being politically correct, you're covering it up, you're not minimizing?
Well, I try to do is diversify my column, either personalities or programs that are trying to get to the root causes of violence. And to kind of bring these people out in the fold, people that the readership doesn't know about or chooses to ignore or doesn't want to see at the breakfast table. And I that's my conscious goal, is to say, look, the Twin Cities getting more and more diverse, and we got to deal with these issues both from what I call the crime side, but also from the economic development side, too.
What about the fact that crime doesn't always go up? Sometimes crime goes down. Is that hard to cover? Or New York, for example, has been much discussed as a place where crime is at some historically low levels. At least homicides have had historically low levels. Can you report that?
All levels of crime are down. I mean, that's the truth. But crime reporting probably is up because crime reporting is very inexpensive and the audience loves it. Every time a TV station in particular does less crime reporting and goes so-called higher road, their ratings take a nosedive. And so it has to be covered, but there's a way to cover it so that it has some more meaning and also covering, you know, the water board as well as the local homicide.
Ruben?
Crime not only sells, it's very easy to produce. You know, just go out with your camera and take a view of the, you know, flashing lights, police lights and the yellow tapes and people anguishing and crying on the streets. That's great stuff. But the thing is that we're going to be dumbing down crime even more now because there's dwindling resources in the newsroom and there's more and more airspace to fill. And how are you going to fill that with less people? Mm. You're going to cover the easiest thing subject you can cover, and that's crime.
But even having said that, all of you have done award-winning work, and I did want to, in the couple of minutes that we have left, ask you if there is something that you're working on now that you'd like the rest of the country to know about. Kara?
We have some statistics that 1 in 3 Native American women will be raped in her lifetime. And we also know from other government research that 70% to 80% of the perpetrators are non-Indian men who know that they can perpetrate on Indian land and not face the same prosecution. I've been working on some of the policy issues, which is essentially that though reservations, though Indian nations have their own police and courts, Congress has tied their hands from prosecuting felony cases, leaving the responsibility to the FBI and federal prosecutors who are smaller in numbers and don't get around to it. And it's a national scandal because the federal policies that are halting the investigation and prosecution of these crimes.
Kathy, what about you?
I did a small piece last summer about white T-shirts and is it a friend or a foe of the police. For here in the city, you see just about everyone walking down the street, mostly males, and they all have white T-shirts. And sometimes those are the ones that the police look to. That's the description that's always given. You know, he's got a white T-shirt on some jeans. But for a lot of those males, it's because it's an economical issue. You can go into, you know, Kmart, Walmart, Target, and get a pack of, you know, 6 T-shirts for maybe $10, and that's pretty much all they can afford. So this white T-shirt, it kind of stifles some of the young black men, but then sometimes it's just an economical issue.
So just the fact that you're wearing a white T-shirt, it's such a standard identifier that people get caught up in being misidentified just because they're wearing a white T-shirt.
Exactly. If you've got a corner full of, you know, boys that are just talking, they have all just probably come out of the store. And then you've got maybe a few blocks away where someone did do something wrong and they had on that white T-shirt. You've got a whole sea of white T-shirts now and the police is pulling over everyone because of the white T-shirt.
That's interesting. Tiwa, what about you?
I'm doing a story about how police respond depending on the race of the victim. There was a young Mexican immigrant woman, a young mother, 18 years old, holding her 11-month-old daughter in her arms, who was used as a human shield when two drug dealers started to shoot at each other. She was shot and killed holding her baby. And the police jailed the one who did the shooting. They never bothered to catch the person who held her. And I think if she had been, frankly, wealthy and white, they would have combed the ends of the earth to find the killer.
Wow. We'll look for that. Ruben, what about you?
I'm going to be looking back. I did a column in 1998 on a program called Delinquents Under 10. It was an effort to identify these young kids, 10 and under, bring in a system of integrated services not only for the kid but for the families, and then monitor their progress, both academic and both in terms of living, for 10 years. So by the time they turn 18, they would have judged whether this kid entered anyway into a life of criminal juvenile delinquency or not. What I'm trying to do is track those kids and see what happened to them.
Ruben Rosario is a columnist for the Pioneer Press in Minnesota. He joined us from Minnesota Public Radio. Tiwa Chang is an investigative reporter for WWOR-TV, a Fox station in New York and New Jersey. He joined us from our New York bureau. Kara Briggs is a columnist for Indian Country Today. She joined us by phone from Tulalip Tribes Reservation. And Kathy Cheney reports for the Chicago Defender. She joined us from WBEZ. I thank you all so much for speaking with us, and I thank you all for your hard work.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Remember, at Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. A group of crime reporters just described for us how they confront the issues of race and crime, how they try to avoid stereotypes while telling what they hope is a more complete story. Now we want to know what you think about how crime is covered where you live. Is there enough? Too much? Is it fair? To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Again, that's 202-842-3522. Or you can visit the Tell Me More page at npr.org. Today on our website, we're also going to introduce you to a group that's working hard to fight Chicago crime and a local family coping with a very recent loss, the murder of 15-year-old Percy Rounds just a few days ago. And now it's time for Wisdom Watch. It's our weekly conversation with distinguished elders, people who can share not just knowledge, but hopefully wisdom gained from years of accomplishment. Today's guest grew up on the south side of Chicago, a place that has always loomed large in the history and politics of this country, and never more so than now because of presumed Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama. He often speaks of the city's south side that gave him his start as a community organizer.
I'm reminded of the Latino brothers and sisters I organized with and stood with and fought with side by side for jobs and justice on the streets of Chicago. I was a young organizer then, a young organizer intent on fighting joblessness and poverty on the south side. I've walked arm in arm with community leaders on the south side of Chicago. I marched with you in the streets of Chicago.
The work I did many years ago in Chicago to help lift neighborhoods that were devastated by the closure of a local steel plant.
Joining us to talk about his work as a community organizer in Chicago is John Owens, who worked with Obama in the 1980s. Welcome. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
First of all, what does a community organizer do?
Well, primarily a community organizer is someone who goes into an area and builds relationships with community residents for the purpose of understanding what their, you know, values and vision is for the area and sets about the work of helping them to achieve it.
How did you get started in this work?
I'd always had an interest in community development, and I got a degree in urban geography from Chicago State University. And, you know, after working at the Department of Planning for the city of Chicago for a brief period of time, I landed a job with an organization called Friends of the Parks, a local park advocacy group. One day while I was at work, Barack Obama walked into the office and we began to, you know, have a conversation about, you know, neighborhoods and just what it takes to actually make some things change in a major way. You know, I could see that he was very astute and knowledgeable and had a certain perspective about things. And he began to talk to me about community organizing and the work that organizers do. One thing led to another, and he invited me to a 2-week leadership training event.
So you went and got some actual training in how to get people interested?
First of all, mm-hmm. How to build relationships with people and understand what motivates them, what are the kind of things that basically makes them tick. And that involves a whole range of skills, building relationships, understanding public policy, understanding how to conduct effective meetings, everything from, you know, how to raise money, how to help people understand the importance of money, how to help people from the community think strategically.
What do you like about your work?
The thing I like most about my work is the relationship-building aspect of things. Actually sitting down, trying to understand what it is that concerns them, you know, helping them move from a point of feeling not that things can't change to a point where things can change and helping them take action on their values and their dreams.
Speaking of dreams, you figure in a Barack Obama's book, Dreams from My Father. Have you ever read it?
Yes.
You're,
I have. It's been a while, but I've read it. Mm-hmm, yes.
I think he was your mentor, right? Wasn't it that he brought you into the organization and kind of helped
right,
you get
yes,
started?
Right.
Were you disappointed when He went on to law school after working in the community for a number of years.
Well, it was a little bit of a, you know, a mixed feeling. I mean, you know, I came out there to work with him, and obviously him leaving didn't allow for that to happen. I was very comfortable with the way he left. I mean, he was honest and upfront about the challenges that I would face. He left the organization in a very good position. So, I mean, it was a good transition.
That kind of leads me to a question, which is I think some people wonder why there are still community organizers, if you want to call it that, just because there have been times in this country when people have been specifically excluded from access to institutional power. And we live in a time in which it is groups of people, whole groups of people are not specifically excluded from power. There are people in Congress who were formerly, you know, on welfare. I can think of at least two. There are people, you know, at all levels of political involvement who've had all from all kinds of different backgrounds. And so I think some people would say, well, how come that doesn't take care of it? Why isn't elected leadership enough? Why isn't it enough for people to just be involved in the system, as it were? Why is there still a need for somebody like you, who is not an elected leader per se, is not a public official, to get people in the neighborhoods to advocate for them or to help them advocate for themselves? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear clearly what you're saying. And I would answer that simply by saying because we still got significant problems out there that need to be solved. And I think that it's important that people begin the process of solving those problems for themselves. I mean, taking case in point, we have a huge problem right now in Chicago around gangs and youth violence. And there's been a lot of research around what the solutions could be or should be. And, you know, nevertheless, you know, there doesn't seem to be enough of a organized, strategic response in any community in Chicago to address that problem.
What do you think that you do as a community organizer that a politician doesn't do?
The one thing that I think I do is to bring people together for their own self-interest and not the interest of one particular political entity. And I think that allows people to think about what it is they want to achieve, irregardless of whether or not it's going to be good for the next election.
Some people are having an existential problem with the possibility that Senator Obama might become president. You know, they are worried that if somebody like him gets to be president, then people will think, you know what, all problems are now solved and we don't have to do anything else. Do you ever worry about that?
Well, I would hope that Barack would be the first person to say that him being elected is only the beginning of a process that needs to happen in terms of our communities, that any president can actually do is set the framework and the context for change, and that the real work of change has to come from communities and the people in them themselves. In other words, he's not going to be able to do for people what they need to do for themselves. He can create a context for that to happen.
We've talked about hopelessness and we've talked about hope. How do you maintain hope?
Well, I believe in Christian principles of hope and how, you know, Jesus taught us that hope is the primary fuel of a good Christian. And I read a lot in terms of people like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and I feel that, you know, it's just, I don't know, the right thing to do to try and pick up on their legacy.
You know, they say that journalists are supposed to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, and I'm not sure how often we actually do that, but it strikes me that you're that guy. Are you that guy?
Well, I guess I am. If I try to do that, but maintain somewhat of a low profile, you know.
Oh, so we're busting you out. We're peeping your card. Are you one of those guys that when the city folks see you coming, they duck? They go, oh, no, here's Johnny Owens again. I'm in trouble.
Yeah, I guess I could be a pain.
Is that ever hard?
You know, we have a saying that if everybody likes you, you're probably not doing your job.
I'm going to remember that. John Owens is a community organizer with the Organization of the Northeast in Chicago. He worked with Senator Obama on the city's south side in the 1980s. Mr. Owens joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. I thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And before we end the program today, we thought we'd leave you with a little bit of music from the Windy City. Chicago is well known for the blues. That music tradition was forever immortalized in the movie The Blues Brothers. The sequel, Blues Brothers 2000, even featured Chicago blues guitarist Lonnie Brooks. Here's a live recording of him performing the popular blues anthem, Sweet Home Chicago, at the annual Chicago Blues Festival in 1980.
Come on! Woman, you are...